All right, this is WBAI New York 99.5 FM and WBAI.org online. The previous program was The Journal of Truth with Margaret Prescott, heard Monday through Thursday at 3 p.m. Stay tuned for Talkback Vantage Point with the professor Ron Daniels coming up. It's 4 p.m. Stay tuned.
Good afternoon. This is the professor, Dr. Ron Daniels, president of the Institute of the Black World 21st Century and distinguished lecturer at York College, Central University of New York, welcoming you to this August 19th edition of Vantage Point here on WBAI 99.5 FM on the Pacifica Network in collaboration with ycradio.org. That is the York College online radio station. Well, this is a momentous day. I'll comment on that in just a moment. But just quickly want to say today our major focus of our show will be the life and legacy of Toni Morrison. A little bit delayed because I just really got back into the country, having traveled to wherever, you know, for some light working R&R. And so therefore I wouldn't have done this show last week, but never too late to get it done. And I'll introduce our guest in just a moment. I also just want to make people aware that I was in Ferguson on August 9th, the fifth anniversary of the police killing of Michael Brown. It was quite a moving experience. Moving in a negative sense, but also in a positive sense. Quite inspirational because people are still struggling and fighting back there in Ferguson as well as St. Louis and around that entire region. And perhaps next week or the following week, we'll bring some guests on who can also share their perspectives on that particular struggle. Also, just need to just remind people that last Saturday, I think it was the birthday of the Honorable Marcus Mosiah Garvey. We should never forget that. In fact, we should spend more time, you know, dealing with the life and legacy and contribution of arguably one of the greatest, or maybe the greatest, mass organizer of black people of all time, Marcus Mosiah Garvey. So we also want to note that. And, of course, I've been a proponent of using Garvey's birthday as what I call Universal African Flag Day. Here in New York, very often, you know, if it's the Puerto Rican Day Parade, Dominican, whatever, you know, the flags are everywhere. And yet we have the red, black, and green, but it is not displayed as vigorously and as voluminously and as broadly as I think it ought to be. So who knows, one of these days, maybe my little utterings on that subject will come to fruition. And finally, and I will comment on this at the end of the show, this is the actual date, August 19th, 1619, 400 years ago, the first arrival of enslaved indentured Africans to these hostile American shores. And that is worth contemplating, thinking about, reflecting on this actual day, 400 years ago in Jamestown, what would become the colony of Virginia. And of course, there's tremendous amounts of organizing being done around that. Delegations are going and coming to Ghana and various other places in Africa. And of course, you're aware that Reverend Dennis Dillon has organized a major contingent to go to Senegal and Ghana, Nigeria, and South Africa in November. So we'll be talking about that as well. But our major discussion today is the life and legacy of Toni Morrison. And she was an incredible person, a giant, if you will. And we have asked two giants to join us to talk about her life and legacy. First up, we have Dr. Haki Madhubuti, longtime friend who has done so much. His resume is so extensive. He has been dedicated to the question of building independent black institutions, among other things. But he has published now more than 30 books. And, of course, is the president and founder of the Third World Press, an independent black publishing company, and many, many, many more things. And is about to complete his second biography, as I do out here in 2020. But to me, more than anything else, someone who's been about this struggle for his entire, most of his life. And we often talk to each other about the fact that we've been doing this for our entire lives. I am so honored that he would come and join us today. And so we welcome to these to Vantage Point once again, Dr. Haki Madhubuti. Haki, welcome to Vantage Point.
Oh, very happy to be with you, Dr. Daniels. How you feel?
Oh,
how
things are going? Things are fine. Things are, you know, like you said before, we've been on this struggle a long time. So we have to, at this stage, I think, keep a pretty even keel in the middle of all of the stuff that's swirling around. But I really wanted to reach out to you because of, the death of Toni Morrison, such a formidable figure. But, you know, because you've been in the forefront of talking about the importance of art, literature. I mean, you've been on that. You've stayed on the course reminding that us of that. And I wanted to share that with our audience. So I just wanted to begin by asking you, because I just don't know. I never met Toni Morrison. I may have been in her presence one time. How well did you know Toni Morrison?
Well, I knew her, but I did not know her well enough to say that we were "quote unquote friends." Say for instance, I did not know her as well as say Sonia Sanchez.
Oh yeah, of course.
And I mentioned Sonia in the context that about 3 weeks ago, I called Sonia around some matters which I do not remember. But she was actually in the hotel room. I mean, in the hospital room of Toni Morrison. Okay, and so she said, "Haki, I'm with Toni. You want to speak to her?" I said, "Of course." And we talked, and, you know, Toni said, "Haki, when are you coming to see me? When are you coming to see me?" I said, "Well, as soon as you get out of the hospital, I'll be there. You know, just give me a little bit of time." And, of course, she passed about a week later.
Wow.
Now, I met Toni Morrison in 1970. The great writer and biographer and historian, Paula Gettings, who was a editor at Random House, working with Toni Morrison, had come to Chicago to recruit me to publish with Random House. My third book, Don't Cry Scream, has sold over 75,000 copies in less than a year. And they wanted to pick that book up and publish it through Random House. I told Paula that I'm not going to publish outside of Broadside Press at this point, but I'd never been to New York. This was 1970. And so could you bring me to New York and take me through Random House and so forth? And that did happen. But I did not realize at that point that I would meet Toni Morrison, because she was one of the top editors there, senior editor there. And so she took me to Toni Morrison's office, and Toni said, my name was Donnell Lee at that time. She said, "Don, you know you're coming with us." And I had to tell her that, you know, I have some reservations. I need to stay where I'm at this point. But I just wanted to, you know, come here and meet you and so forth. She had not published The Bluest Eye yet. But she was known as a serious editor and writer herself. So that was the first time I met her. Second time that we spent time together was when Spike Lee was premiering the Malcolm X movie. And I was escorting Betty Shabazz and the daughters to the premiere in New York. And as I approached the theater, Toni and a friend, they were at the corner in a restaurant having dinner, I believe. And so I was able to sit down and just talk to her for a few minutes. And a question I asked her, I said, what do you think people are missing, and most certainly critics are missing, from your work? And she said there were two things. One, I do not think they appreciate the language I use, the language of black people, the language. And number two, they do not appreciate what I would call my Africanness, that I basically have explored the serious element of black people being from Africa, part of Africa, and have this Africanist background that has, in many ways, been beaten out of too many of us. And she talked about the contemplation of the black presence and which is, she said, central to any understanding of our national literature, and should not be permitted to hover at the margins of literary imagination. So she was not only a great novelist, great fiction writer, but she was a thinker. She was a philosopher. She was a person who essentially went subsurface in terms of understanding who we are and what we are as a people and where we are as a people and our own journey in order to get to this place. Along with her novels, she published nonfiction also. One of the major books I use in my courses, and I taught Toni Morrison. The major book I taught of Toni Morrison was Sula, the novel. But there's one of her major nonfiction books was Playing in the Dark, Whiteness and the Literary Imagination. And I just want to make a quote from her because this is critical. And she writes in the essay, the first essay in the book, Black Matters, she writes, "More interesting is what makes intellectual domination possible. Wow. How knowledge is transformed from invasion and conquest, revelation and choice. What ignites and informs the literary imagination, and what forces help establish the perimeters of criticism." Now, what we're seeing here is that she, in that book there, basically noted that most of the writers coming out of the 20th, 19th, and 20th century had not read any black writers. Those, I mean, from Faulkner, Hemingway, I mean, the major writers coming out didn't know anything about black literature for the most part, but they were celebrated as being great writers, great men, and so forth and so on.
Right.
And so she was fighting not only that reality, but she was about essentially, rather than reacting, she was essentially making her own, or our own reality, you see, in the novels that she published. And as a result of that, she elevated all of us, not only from The Bluest Eye in Suva, but most certainly from Song of Solomon, Tar Baby, and Beloved. And the last piece I read, last book I read of hers in terms of fiction was God Help the Child. And she's still dealing with the same questions of who we are and where we are and why is it that we cannot, you know, get beyond this white supremacist culture that beat us up each and every day. And so she is more than a writer, more than a great writer. She was a presence. Mm. And in that presence, in fact, the last time I was with her was at Hunter College. This was about maybe 10, 15 years ago. But we were at a program together, and I don't even remember the context of the program. All I do is remembering helping her up on the stage to sit down and to talk about literature and what have you. So she will be missed. But I think that what we need to concentrate on is two things. One, celebrating her even being up among us, and celebrating what she left us. I mean, much like Gwendolyn Brooks, okay? She, as Gwendolyn Brooks was at the top of her line as a poet, Toni Morrison was at the top of her line as a fiction writer who wrote fiction as if she was a poet, okay?
Mm, wow.
And this is the clear thing. And finally, before you get back to questioning me, I just want to read one more quote, because she was on a mission. And I think that the mission was completed. And I think that when you read her novels, you begin to understand black women, women of African ancestry, I mean, clear. And that those of us, especially men, who dwell in this whole avenue of ideas and dealing with the black community, need to read Toni Morrison at a level of saying, how can I understand my own community at another level? But this is what I want to read, because she writes about the responsibility of writers. She says that writers are among the most sensitive, the most intellectually anarchic, most representative, probing of artists. The ability of writers to imagine what is not the self, to formalize the strange and mystify the familiar, is a the language they use and the social and historical context in which these languages signify are indirect and direct revelations of that power and its limitations. So it is to them, the creators of American literature, that I look for clarification about the invention and effects of Africanism in the United States. And my early assumptions as a reader were that black people signify little or nothing in the imagination of white American writers, other than as the objects of an occasional bout of jungle fever, over then to provide local color or to lend some touch of restitude or to supply a needed moral gesture, humor, or a bit of pesos, black made no appearance at all. So Morrison took all that on, saying that my responsibility, number one, is to reflect my community. But in the reflection of her community, she did something for all of us that especially writers and poets and thinkers and intellectuals and philosophers and so forth, black and otherwise. She said, essentially, if you are doing your job, you actually are the freest people in the world. Those artists, whether they're writers or visual artists or the whatever area of creative art you work in, you're free. Now, you compromise the administration. You compromise that freedom by not telling the truth about what is happening during your time today. And she never did compromise that. And that was the beauty, the real beauty of Toni Morrison.
Well, that's why, Haki, I wanted you to take on this task, because for me, sort of looking at her, getting an occasional clip or quote, you had a sense of this profound militancy, is not the right word, but in a way it is, that it was like there was the veneer, but underneath that veneer, people in a general sense didn't sort of grab what, you know, Toni Morrison was really all about, and her real serious dedication to black people, her real serious dedication to African people, and this whole notion about, and I want you to explore that more, this whole notion of the language, that she spoke in the language of black people, and what that meant in terms of people not, particularly in the white world, not appreciating her, but even to some extent, maybe even some of us as African people ourselves.
Well, the only way one can appreciate the language of Toni Morrison is basically go to the fiction, is to read Beloved, to read Sula, and to take into account the type of relationships that she was able to develop as a result of a deep examination of us, our people. And actually, she even goes deeper into the whole question of language, the whole question of pathos, the whole question of nuance, and the whole question of essentially who we are in her last book. Her last book is titled The Source of Self-Regard, and it's a collection of essays that kind of cover the whole spectrum of Toni Morrison. Very few of us realize, very few people outside of her immediate family, extended family, and readers and so forth, recognize that she was also a professor. She was a teacher most of her life, even before she became an editor. She was on the faculty at Howard University, and of course she ended up on the faculty at Princeton University. And so she was a teacher as well as a writer. And she was a mother and a wife, okay? Mm. The wife that didn't last that long, that part, I think about 6 or 7 years, but her two sons and that they had as a result of that. But so she experienced what sisters experience, what brothers in many cases experience. So the last book, The Source of Self-Regard, actually was published this year, Selected Essays, Speeches, and Meditations by Toni Morrison. So this quest into language, it means essentially her quest into the uncharted mindset, the uncharted daily lives of black people that very few outside of our community can ever get to,
Right.
You see? And this is why for Toni Morrison, people like Sonia Sanchez, people like Tony K. Bambara,
right.
You know, we're very critical and very important. people like Angela Davis. I mean, they were very important in terms of what she did as an editor at Random House. So for me, I need to mention this. There's a new movie out on her life. My wife and I went to see it about 3 weeks ago.
Okay.
It was at the theater here in Chicago, and it dealt with the life of Toni Morrison. And so for the generally close to the first half of the movie, she's talking about her literary projection and how she began to write and et cetera, giving the background of her family, born in Ohio and so forth, and how she moved to Howard and et cetera. But also, you got people like Sonia Sanchez. You got people like Paula Geddes. You got people like the great, novelist. I can't even think of his name now. But the mystery novelist whose books have been made into movies also. Devin in the Blue Dress. I can't even think of his name. But my point always is that she was not afraid to go up against that which she was not supposed to touch, you see. And in all of her books, she was revelatory about our lives as Black people, as people of African ancestry in this country, who came here. This was a forced migration, because we're talking about migration now. Black people did not choose to come here or come to the Western Hemisphere at all.
Right.
We were away from Africa and brought here by people who cared nothing about us at all, you see, and treated us less than human, almost as property, just like cattle and pigs and so forth, you see. And so our 400-year battle, which is being acknowledged this year. In fact, last week's New York Times acknowledged it in its magazine section and another section in the New York Times, Sunday New York Times. In fact, so yesterday's New York Times. So if you haven't seen that, Rob, pick it up. It's actually pretty good.
Right. I'll definitely do that. So, Hockey, one of the reasons I wanted your voice here is because you have been a fervent, persistent articulator of the view that this art and literature is so liberating for Black people. And so you mentioned earlier that Toni Morrison achieved her objective. She did what she was supposed to do. So where do we go from here? Where do you see, because we're in an interesting era. There is this 400-year commemoration that's taking place. There's a kind of, you know, a revival of sorts, and people are going back and forth to Africa. The reparations movement is surging in a way that, you know, many would not have believed. I certainly would not have believed, and I'm with the Institute of the Black World 21st Century and the National African American Reparations Commission. We're sort of in the center of that in many respects.
Right.
But then we're also in the midst of this outburst, this sort of, and I had a show a couple of weeks ago, and we focused on John Henry Clark's White Nationalism, Enemy of Black Nationalism. So you now have white nationalism out in full display and full force under the Orange Man, 42, or whatever
right.
people want to call him. So where do you see us moving in relationship to what Toni Morrison's goals and objectives were for we as Black people understanding ourselves, and your constant admonition that art and culture is a liberating force?
Well, art and culture are critical, because if you don't know who you are, anybody can name you, and they will. And if you don't know, if you do not know the parallels and essentially the in-depth travels that we've taken as a result of being here in North America, and do not recognize essentially that the first genocide was against Native Americans
right.
by the people who stole us from Africa and brought us here to build a country which they just took from Native Americans. That history needs to be taught, but it's not taught. And that it is critical to understand that the greatest enemy of, say, for instance, white men, as they see it, are Black men. So therefore, they create structures and substructures in order to make sure that the movement of Black men was very limited. In fact, it has now known that the sixth greatest killer of Black men, behind, you know, heart attacks, behind, you know, things like that, was basically police killing of black men across the country. And so you see this disregard for the lives of black people and black men in particular not subsiding at all. So our responsibility as writers, as poets, as workers, as people who understand the dynamics of white male supremacy and white supremacy, period, because I don't want to take women out of this, because I call the Jim Crow period, I call the Jim Jane Crow period, because that could not exist with white women being involved in that, and 45 would not been elected if white women had not voted overwhelmingly for him. You see what I'm saying?
Right.
And so that we have to, but now at the same time, I am not saying in any way that there are not good white people in America or the world. I'm not suggesting that. What I am suggesting is that those good white people are in a minority, number one. And number two, they don't have any power for the most part.
Right.
Okay? And therefore, we as black men and women and young people of conscience, we cannot let up. But what is critical, and this is what we have three schools in Chicago that are African-centered. We got the New Concept School, which is a preschool. We got the Betty Chavez Academy, which is K-8. We got the Barbara Ann Sizemore Academy, which is K-8. And it's not an accident that we named them after women, all right? Why? Because in many cases, women have been the backbone of the black community, but they have been unsung, all right? And so Toni Morrison falls, you know, not directly into that category, and since that she was sung and she was able to get credit while she was alive. And so for us, we must continue to build independent black institutions, number one. Number two, understand the absolute necessity of families, of black families. And it's critical. You know, often, you know, we the question to me when I run around the country speaking and say, why is it black children are not reading? And my answer is a very simple one. That's because their mothers and fathers are not reading if they got their mothers and fathers.
Wow.
You know what I'm saying? Culture is so critical that I can walk into your home right now, Dr. Daniels, and tell you exactly where you are culturally. As soon as I walk into your home, the first thing I want to see, is it clean? That's number one. Number two, I'm going to walk into your living room and see what are the images on the walls in your living room. Are they liberating images of your family, of your community, and so forth, or, you know, black visual art? Then I'm going to look in your bookcase if you got a damn bookcase. You know what I'm saying? What are you reading?
Right.
What are you reading? Because that defines you. Then I'm going to go to you, the music you're streaming. What are you listening to? Are you listening to great black music? Are you listening to booty call music? What are you listening to? And then I'm going to go to the music. What kind of movies you looking at? You know, are you looking at the great black movies or what are you looking at? And especially the movies wrapped up in a brown paper bag. But to really tell that family is going to the children's room. What's on their walls? Mickey Mouse, Donald Duck, you know, Darth Vader. And you wonder why we're confused. That we have to move our lives out of our own self-confusion to a level of who are you? How do you define yourself? What is your name? How do you name your children? What kind of context are you bringing them up in? This is why family is so critical, you see. And so culture is a defining element in the lives of all people, not just people of African ancestry. And Toni Morrison understood that, stayed on point, did not give up all of her life to the last book that she published, The Source of Self-Regard, is expanding upon that concept and the beauty of people of African descent, Africanists, black people.
Well, Haki, this has been extraordinary. I know when I first called you, you're traveling all over the world, not letting up. Speaking of not letting up, you certainly are not letting up. When I reached you, you were in Japan. And
and
you said, well, I don't know. If my schedule is clear, I'll do it. And I was praying that your schedule would be clear because I wanted you definitely to lead this discussion for us here on WBAI 99.5 FM, you know, where we have these kinds of conversations. So we really, really appreciate you so much taking the time to be with us. And we look forward to seeing you in the future. And it's good to hear that energy and that passion that's still there, you know, as you continue to that struggle that you've been, like you said before, we've been waging this struggle all of our lives, and you continue to wage it magnificently and in a way that we urgently need, because we old folks say we're showing what we want to be, showing what we're going to be, but we're showing what we were. But we still have a long way to go to rescue and restore the race to where we ought to be. So thank you so much. Really, really appreciate it.
No, thank you, Dr. Daniels. And you keep up the good work with Institute of Black World 21st Century. Really love you, brother. You stay strong. I'll talk to you soon.
All right. Thank you so much. Really appreciate it. Wow, that was really, really, I think, powerful. The kind of stuff that I really, really like to bring to our listeners here on WBAI. And, of course, we got the second segment, another great thinker is coming right behind him, Dr. Malepi Asante. Just a couple of quotes, if you will, from Toni Morrison. She says, in this country, American means white. Everything else has to hyphenate. Let me say that again. In this country, American means white. Everything else has to hyphenate. And then the quote that Haki was talking about, the assault on black men, and I wish we had had time to tease that out, because sometimes people misunderstand that, the attack on black men. And it's not that there has not been an attack on black women. As I interpret it, and I may be wrong, in a patriarchal society, and that's what we've lived in, a patriarchal society, then that which is most dangerous is the opposite patriarch. And so the white patriarch has to subdue the black patriarch, but the perception of the black patriarch, in order to subdue the race. And then, of course, in doing that, that submission gets into questions like the rape and humiliation of that black man and in front of the black woman, and the emasculating the black man. And I'm not advocating that, because I think, you know, I'm for gender equality, and this whole patriarchal system needs to be wiped out. But I'm just saying that is, if you're in a patriarchal system, then the attack you have to attack your counterpart, and you have to humiliate, marginalize, denigrate, and kill, either physically, spiritually, or culturally, your enemy. And that's what the attack on black men has meant. But as a result of that, it has also meant the rape, pillage, and just the rape is the best word, of black women repeatedly and continually, on the marginalization, destruction of the black family in a way that is unconscionable and needs to be repaired. We're going to take a brief break here for announcements on what else is happening at WBAI. And when we come back, the next voice you hear will be that of Dr. Malepi Asante. We'll be right back.
Listener-sponsored non-commercial WBAI Pacifica Radio in New York is holding open debates of issues facing the station and the network. The forums are with all WBAI local station board members, LSB members, current staff, and listener members, as well as those currently running to join the LSB. You are invited to participate in the discussions. That's Sundays at 2 p.m. on August 25th, September 8th, and on September 22nd. These LSB forums are at the 60 Wall Street Atrium in Manhattan, and all these debates are open to the public.
The 2019 local station board elections are underway. Visit elections.pacifica.org for candidates' written statements, video cards, and debates. As of August 15th, your ballot will come in one of three forms: an email ballot, a brightly colored postcard, or, if you requested it, a paper ballot from Honest Ballot. If you cannot find your ballot, please fill out a ballot request form on elections.pacifica.org. Members in need of a paper ballot can leave a voicemail at 510-854-9663. Paper ballot replacements will be issued through October 7th. All ballots must be received by October 15th, 11:59 p.m. Eastern Standard Time to be counted. It's 99.5 FM WBAI in New York and online at WBAI.org.
We're back in our tribute to the life and legacy of Toni Morrison. Just heard from Hakeem Adabudi, and what a powerful interview that was, particularly in terms of him literally, Sonia Sanchez, being at the hospital with Toni Morrison when Hakeem called her, and then she asking whether Hakeem would like to speak to Toni Morrison, and that would have been just a week or so before she passed away. I mean, you know, I did not know the degree to which Hakeem knew or had related to Toni Morrison. I just didn't know, so I asked him that question, and it was quite interesting, really, to receive that answer. Black boys became criminalized. I was in constant dread of their lives because they were targets everywhere. They still are. One of the points that Hakeem made was about this attack on black boys. Not that it doesn't occur to black women, but this, as I said earlier, the whole notion of the context of a patriarchal society. She also says, I've always annoyed about why black people have to bear the brunt of everybody else's contempt. If we're not totally understanding and smiling, suddenly we are demons. And finally, she said, I merged two words, black and feminist, because I was surrounded by black women who were tough and who always assumed they had to work hard and rear children and manage homes. These are just a few quotes from Toni Morrison. I am so delighted now to be joined by another one of our giants, making a tribute to giants, to a giant, and one of the giants of our time, without question, is Dr. Malefi Asante, who, among other things, is the architect of Afrocentricity. He is the one who created the theory of it and made us understand it and to talk about how to utilize it. Most recently, had an opportunity to see him at St. Mark AME Church, where he delivered the keynote address for the annual commemoration to Dr. John Henry Clark. It was inspiring and all of the things that go with the work that he's done over these many years, and he's taken time out of his very busy schedule to be with us today. Dr. Malefi Asante, welcome to Vantage Point.
Thank you so much, Dr. Ron. I'm really delighted to be on Vantage Point. Thank you.
Quickly, I'd like to just ask you also, because I just don't know, the fact that you're in Philadelphia didn't necessarily mean that you knew Toni Morrison or interacted with her.
Absolutely.
But I want to ask, what was your relationship, or how well did you know Toni Morrison?
Well, you know, I'm one of those people. I mean, I've sort of knew of Toni Morrison, and I met her once. I heard her three times to give presentations. But my first meeting with her was not a success. It was actually through letters. And I give this because I'm sure that on the commemoration, everybody's talking about how great their relationship was with her, and they knew her this way and that way. I was a Fulbright scholar in Zimbabwe in 1981 and 82. And in fact, I was the first African-American to go to Zimbabwe immediately after the Chimurenga, the second Chimurenga, and I worked in mass communication. But at the time, I wrote a novel that later was called Scattered to the Wind. It was an attempt to write a historical saga about African experience, something that was not comic but serious in terms of relationships. So I remember Toni Morrison, because she rejected my novel. And of course, I appreciated her commentary and her work, but that was my first interaction, because I said she was at Random House, and so let me just send it to this sister at Random House and see what she thought. And she could find nobody at Random House who was interested in it, and she was not interested in it at the time. But I accepted that, but that was my first inclination, or rather my first interaction. My second interaction was much different. We invited her to Temple University during the time that Sonia Sanchez was also here on the faculty with us at Temple. And it was a beautiful meeting. We had a big reception for her. She gave a wonderful, glowing adulation to what we were trying to do here at Temple. And it was out of those experiences that, of course, I began to read her. And, in fact, I teach her. I'm teaching her this fall. And the interesting thing about Toni Morrison is that she was an immense treasure, a trove, actually, of ideas and concepts that come directly from the African-American people. Mm. And I put her, I'm sure as others probably have told you, in the same sense as you would put Richard Wright or Ralph Ellison or Gwendolyn Brooks or James Baldwin or Octavia Butler. She was the soul and the spirit of the African-American genius. We are less of a nation because of her death. We are in fact deprived as a people, in my judgment, because of the beautiful ways that she understood the nuances and the intricacies of African American culture. And I'm from the South. I grew up in Georgia and Tennessee. I was born in Georgia, working in the tobacco and the cotton fields. And yet, she resonated with me in many ways, like Zora Neale resonated with me, in the sense of the language and the understanding of this intricate culture, this beautiful culture, this essence of soul and power that is in the African American vocabulary of emotions and with whether it was joy or fear or strangeness or victory. Toni Morrison had all of that, and her characters always seemed to me to always be us and to be everyone, actually. I mean, you could find yourself in her characters. And I'm just really saddened by her loss. One of the great things we do is to probe her work for philosophy. Sometimes, you know, we think sometimes philosophers have to be schooled philosophers or people who write dense commentaries on certain things. But when you read her, as you read all of our great novelists and writers, you understand how uncomplicated things can be when you're telling the truth. And that's the way I sort of remember Toni Morrison, as clear. And when you, as an Afrocentrist, what I also like about her was the notion of location, of locating her stories with inside the culture and making Africans, women particularly, agents within the narrative, so that that our historical experiences, our social experiences, our relationships are centered in the story. We're not marginal. And she did not make her people marginal. She made them central characters in understanding the world. So that's what I wanted, you know, really to deliver, to get over to the audience, that we are a blessed nation, blessed world, because her life was fluid, like water, like life, and uncomplicated in the sense that she was able to tell us things directly and that were also daring.
Dr. Malefi Asante, you're listening to him. I neglected to say in my excitement that he is also obviously a prolific author, but also the professor and founder of the Department of Afrocology at Temple University, which is extraordinarily important because there have been so many who have come through that department who are now, for lack of a better term, you know, there are the seeds that he planted that are out there producing and growing and publishing and writing and teaching and all over the place. He is really one of the great giants of our era. And I look forward really to to having him back. Because one of the things that I try to do on this show, I'm going to get back to our major sources, I always learn more about people. Like, he's talking about being in the tobacco fields, and I said, whoa, the Malefi did all that? See, so, because what happens is, Malefi, a lot of times is when people see you and Haki and all, you know, I don't say myself to some degree, they just see the public face, you know, the person who's lecturing. But, you know, people, I'd like to get into who are you? What did you, where did you come from? What are the influences? You know, and I'm sure you teach that way. I teach that way, too. I said, you got to get into what people are about. And very often, activists are reluctant to do that. They want to rush right to the top. I said, no. Tell
That's
people.
Right.
And inevitably, I find out stuff. Whoa, just like, you know, you and I are going to explore. I got roots in Georgia. You got roots in Georgia.
That's
I said, whoa, we're going to talk about some of those things, you know.
Okay.
But finally, let me just talk about this piece. Because you and Haki, it was interesting to hear the two of you talk about this and the whole question of language. And, of course, you have been very strong on the question of Afrocentricity, Karenga on the question of culture, and Haki the same thing. And I guess one of the things I this language piece, have we really grasped the whole concept of embracing who we are as being authentic? And I say that because the language, you know, there's this great beauty of the language, the meaning of it, and how language is used. And then in another kind of way, just in terms of the whole enslaved experience, how we did the Negro spirituals and the multiple, all that richness. And I still wonder, you know, have we really grasped that and embraced that as who we are, as opposed to this constant sort of dual consciousness, as Du Bois would talk about it, and the whole notion of sort of the need for white acceptance of who we are. I mean, you've been at this so long. What's your sense of where we are?
This is a brilliant question, and I really appreciate you for asking this question, for probing this area. Here's my take on it, Dr. Ron. The two things that we are most credited with, and perhaps most, the two things that are most authentic to our experience in the American context may very well be our language and our music. And in many respects, our language, because of the creative nature of the language that we speak, that is, I always call it an African language with African phonemes, built over an African structure, but with many lexical items and vocabulary items that come from the English language, we've created a totally different language.
Right.
That's why I always say that when we elongate our vowels, even though the word seems to be an English word, it is not an English word for me. To elongate a vowel when I'm trying to show a superlative, when I say that was a long train, well, that's not English speakers don't speak like that.
That's right.
But
that's
African
right.
speakers speak like that.
Right.
So in effect, we have taken the lexical items, the lexicon of English, we have put it into the structure of African phonemes and African grammar, even in many cases, and we have provided something that's new. And this is why each generation, whether it is rapping, or scatting, each generation seems to come forth with a different a part of that same deep structure of language that really is a part of the soul of African people in this country. So that's one thing. The second part of it is this, that we also have been very keen to erase from our language those things that have been degrading to us, or when language is used in a degrading way, as it was in the very beginning of the enslavement of Africans, we have gradually gotten rid of those things. That's why we moved a long ways from the term Negro, for example.
Right.
And we kept moving. We kept moving because part of it is our consciousness was different. And in effect, the real liberation of African people will come where we no longer have to move from our own location, psychological or social, philosophical in understanding ourselves. And that time is coming fast. I see it with the young people. I see it also with the expressions that people are having in terms of how we relate to even concepts like double consciousness, which I think, which I don't use. I don't because I don't believe in that. I always tell people, when I grew up in Valdosta, Georgia, I had no double consciousness. I didn't want to be nobody. I knew who I was. It was very, very clear. I think there are some cases where people do have these choices that really impact them, but it did not. There was no lure of double consciousness for me, and that has always been the thing that I have tried to promote when I'm trying to explain to people that the African person has to be located with the African person or man or woman in the center of his or her narrative. If you on the margins and you are somebody who is an object, you can even be victimized. But if you are in the center of your own story, you tell your story from through your own eyes, you have a different way to tell the story.
Right.
You know, and that's the way I have seen it.
Well, Dr. Malepi Asante, we were about out of time. I need a couple of minutes to talk about this 400th anniversary. This is a significant day, as you well know, in the history of of Africans globally, particularly Africans in America. So we're going to bring you back because we could talk a couple of hours here.
I would love to come back.
Right. So thank you so much. I know you were very, very busy. You took time, and I really, really appreciate it. So thank you so much.
I appreciate you. Thank you, sir.
All right. Dr. Malepi Asante, oh, wow, what a show today. I'm thrilled by it, and it's the kind of shows that I really like to bring to our listening audience here on Vantage Point and have the privilege of doing so. I just want to close, and I only have a few minutes left, but I did want to just deal with this issue of language because a few years ago there was this whole discussion, Smitherman, I'm forgetting her first name now, and the whole thing about Ebonics, there was a whole discussion about that. We do have, as black people, our own language. And that language percolates. I smile all the time. And it really captivates the larger society. You know, you run into somebody and they'll use a phrase that comes right out of the black language experience. And because it percolates, I mean, people emulate us because of the nature of the language that we have. But finally, let me say, as Hakeem Adebudi said, it is important to reflect on this day. 400 years ago, enslaved Africans, indentured Africans were brought to these shores, not because they were inferior, because it was known that they were not inferior. They came as carpenters and craftspersons and great planters and great builders of great civilizations with roots going back thousands of years to these hostile American shores, one of the original sins, whose free labor helped build these United States of America. And in fact, whose free labor in the broader context, as written by Walter Rodney and How Europe Underdeveloped Africa and Sir Eric Williams and Capitalism and Slavery in so many volumes, the free labor of black people built these United States, Europe. I mean, it's on the back of black labor. But it is also important, and I was so happy that Haki noted this, on the dispossession of native people. The dispossession, the ripping up, the tearing of the seizure of this land from the native people, the indigenous people. We must always remember that, another sin. And there are other sins that we could also catalog: the seizure of territory from Mexico, the ruthless exploitation of Asian labor to build the railroads and other things and to open the mines and so forth. All of that is connected. And as we reflect on the 400 years, we must also make that psychological and, where we can, physical return to Africa to reconnect.
And as Reverend Dennis Dillon has said, we came through a door of no return. We now, during the course of this year, go through a door of our return. And that return is not only psychological and physical, it is spiritual, it is cultural, it is about regaining who we are. And a part of regaining who we are is reparations, the repair of the damage, the physical, mental, spiritual, and cultural damage done to African people. But before it can all be made whole again, this country, the damages to Native Americans must also be repaired. And the damages done to people of Latin origins, the people, Chicanos who came, and the people from Mexico and so forth, who from whom land was seized. And in some sense, also the question of the exploitation even of white working class people in this country is a part of a more perfect union. So a lot to think about on this day, the 400th anniversary of the arrival of the first enslaved Africans on these hostile shores. Because as Malcolm X say, we didn't land on Plymouth Rock. Plymouth Rock landed on us. This is Professor Dr. Ron Daniels. We hope you have learned something from this, I think, incredible show today. We'll be back with another version of Vantage Point here on 99.5 FM on the Pacifica Network, WBAI, next week. We'll see you next week.